Okay, so the basic idea of the talk is that, so what we're going to try and do is redefine smoothness. That's the basic idea of the talk. So let's talk a little more about this. So usually when you talk about an image, you're talking about a function from the unit cube into R or something like that, or maybe a discretized version of it. And what we're going to talk about is that the important thing is the behavior of the function in a neighborhood of a pixel, not just at a pixel. So this is one thing. And the second thing is that the normal definition of close between pixels, which is two pixels are close if they're close together in R2, is not entirely good. So it's going to turn out that the geometry of features that appear in a neighborhood of a pixel have really useful information and have tractable information. And the way we're going to access and use this information is the standard machinery of smoothness. So the standard machinery of harmonic analysis, which has some relationship between smoothness, scale, and frequency. And okay, so that's the main idea. And let's actually start saying something. Okay, so what is the what are some basic image processing tasks? Well, historically, people have wanted to deny stuff. I'm not sure how much in real life, but definitely a lot of people make their careers out of taking Gaussian white noise off of photographs. There are definitely important denoising problems. And then the second thing is compression, and this is definitely something which is historically important and will continue to be so. I mean, when you want to move an image across the web, well, okay, image isn't so bad, but now you want to move a video across the web, it's really important to throw away stuff that you don't care about. And then the last two are somehow slightly related. And so you might want to break an image into pieces. So if it's unsupervised, if someone just gives you an image and you tell the computer to break it into pieces without any help, it's unsupervised segmentation. Maybe if a person is allowed to help the computer, it's a supervised segmentation problem. And this is very related to the in-painting problem, which is someone gives you an image and they take away some of the values of the gray level or some of the pixel values, and you have to put those back. These two are related because in some sense they're both some sort of function extension problem. Now, all of them are related because they're all a question about redundancy of information. In each of these problems, you use some sort of redundancy of information to get something. Compression, there you have redundancy, so you throw some of the redundancy away. Denoising, again, there's some sort of redundancy over the image so that you can ignore the noise. The same with the in-painting. You can fill in pixels that you don't have the value for because there's redundancy in the information. So we model, we won't model an image from the torus to R, but this is kind of a standard modeling. And a standard basic assumption is that neighboring pixels are correlated. So another way of saying the same thing is saying that your function is smooth. If everywhere you look, the value at a pixel is correlated to the, and there's positive correlation between nearby pixels, then you should have some sort of smooth function. And so people, kind of the original granddaddy of all functionals is the integral of the gradient of the image squared. If you're from UCLA, this one you probably like a little bit better. It's the integral of, there's no square. And we'll see the problem with this one in a minute, and in some sense why this one came from, and then where you go from there. Okay, so the problem is, of course, that images are not smooth at all. And the important information is exactly, before I say that, let's say why we care about smoothness. Okay, so we have these functionals like integral of gradient squared, and it tells us some measure of complexity of the image. And why is this good? Smoothness is a really particular form of redundancy of information. It says if you know the value of the pixel, you know something about the neighboring pixels. This is exactly saying there's some redundancy. It's saying there's oversampling, and not only does it kind of say, well, theoretically, there's redundancy of information, it tells you exactly how to use it. if you want to denoise a function which you know is smooth, convolve it with an averaging kernel. If you want to compress it, use a Fourier basis, because you know that a smooth function has decay in Fourier coefficients. If you want to extend a function, you can use harmonic extension. So you know the value at some points, and you want to extend it to other points, so you find the harmonic function with the correct boundary values. And all these things make use of smoothness. So all these things say, well, this is the smoothest function with this particular boundary values. This is some sort of smooth version of your noisy image. This is kind of, we keep only the smoothest bits of the image. Now, of course, so all these things basically say, let's minimize the integral of gradient of I squared, subject maybe to some conditions. So here it's some boundary conditions. Here it's we start off with some noisy image, whatever. But so they all use smoothness. There's a very powerful set of machines that if you have a smooth function, you can really throw away a lot of useless information and keep all the good stuff. Now the problem is that images are not smooth. So you're somehow you're in a little bit of trouble. So this is the Lena image, and most of you have seen the Lena image. This is kind of the pole, and there's the hat. And the point is that it isn't smooth, right? It just isn't a smooth object. So edges obviously are non-smooth, but things like hair are completely crazy. Like hair is positive and negative, and positive and negative, and it's just not a smooth function. I mean, in fact, if someone just showed you this without knowing that it's an image, it looks as a function fairly intractable. I mean, there's a lot of, you can see some structures, but it's really kind of crazy, especially over here. Here, maybe there's a big structure, but anyway, so what can we do? So someone says, well, we have some powerful machines to deal to make use of smoothness. We have a class of signals that aren't smooth. What do we do? Well, the answer is, let's see if we can get a hint from this process. So here's a man carrying a bundle of, I'm not sure, hay or something, and there is a bundle of hay with no man carrying it. And what was done here is,
is that in the Hogwarts?
What? So this is the mask that was taken away. So let me go back up. So basically the legs were masked out, and we try and fill in the remaining pixels. So this is an extension problem. So we have, this is an inpainting problem. We have the value of the pixels at everywhere except here, and we want to know what the pixels there ought to be. So in this case, this is a method by Efros and Leung. And what do? We start off with the red patch. So we randomly pick the red patch to start off with. And it's just the last pixel is in the mask. So this one here is in the mask, right? So we pick something that's mostly not in the mask. And we want to fill in this one pixel. So we search over the image, and we find the nearest patch. So this is a 7x7 patch, and we search over the whole image looking for a patch which is similar to the patch we have, which has one pixel missing. And we fill in this pixel by the value of the pixel of the nearest patch, right? And then, well, so now this pixel is filled in, and we can move this square up and repeat and repeat and repeat and repeat and repeat and repeat. And so that doesn't exactly work. If you did it like that, then what happens is you get a nasty scar up the middle where the two sides collide. And actually, in this particular thing here, I had to cheat and fix it. But people have smart ways of following around the contour. So here's the mask. They have kind of smart ways of choosing which pixel to add on one at a time so that you don't make such a bad scar. And actually, apparently in Photoshop now, you can do this very well. So this was a paper from 1999 or something, so it's very mainstream now. The cool thing is, you might think it's not hard to get these pixels. That's pretty simple, right? They're pretty much, if you pick something of this color, nobody will notice the difference. But the cool thing is, all this is added in. That's all fake, right? And it was done doing that remarkably stupid thing, which is you take a square, it's missing one pixel, you find the nearest pixel, you add it there. And you're able to get a really complicated sort of texture out of that, at least from from a distance looks relatively the same. Actually, if you zoom in on it, it's quite wrong, but from a distance, it looks really good. But that's actually all you want, because, I mean, in some sense, texture really cares about scale. So the point is, just using the similarity between patches, you're able to get a really good idea what ought to be in each place, as long as you update your intelligent way. Yes?
So how did you find what is similar pixel? For example, the shadow is not being reconstructed.
Sorry? The shadow is?
The shadow is not being reconstructed.
Yes, exactly. Because, so, similarity is done by L2. So two patches that are similar, if their Euclidean distance are similar, that's it. And actually, you can see why, in some sense, the shadow, I mean, it started from here, I think, is where it started. So it filled in this way. So I didn't do anything. This was done in the most bare bones manner. And I hate to, well, this their first paper was slightly primitive, but people have made this into an extremely effective tool now, where you choose how you're going to place each new pixel in a very intelligent way. I think this one just picks one to start off with randomly and just starts walking around in a circle from there. So it doesn't pick a very intelligent path to add pixels. So that's why there's flaws. And in some sense, we don't care. This is just a hint for us. This isn't a final goal. But it works really well if you think about. I mean, in some sense, this is a really hard problem. How do you? Well, anyway. The moral of the story is pixel and location isn't enough to infer pixel similarity, but the similarity of two patches really tells you a lot. Like, if you're the same at every point in a patch except for one place, you really know that the two pixels that are at the center of a patch really, in some sense, are similar. So we go back to our problem. We know how to deal with smoothness. We have powerful machines for it, but images aren't smooth. So what's the answer? Well, we redefine smoothness. This is kind of a standard. I mean, if you don't like your definitions, just change them. So we want to redefine. We want to redefine our notion of close. Before, maybe when you talk about gradient, you were talking about two pixels being close together. You take the discrete difference between close together pixels. Okay. Well, here we're not going to do that. We'll say we're going to redefine what close together is. So that has something to do with the structure of the image. So how do we do this? Well, first we choose some feature vectors relevant to the image studied. And then we build a weight matrix on the features, and then we use the weights to define some of this. So we'll talk about what each of these things are. And so the hope is, if we pick our features intelligently, image structure gets converted to smoothness of the pixel values with respect to those features. We need some extra. So there's kind of a conservation of hardness principle in the universe in general. So if you redefine smoothness, you're going to say, well, we're going to have a generalized version of smoothness. You have to pay something, and the something you have to pay is you need to develop a theory for smoothness on more general settings, in more general settings than just on R2. So. Well, but it's not that bad, so we'll see it. So suppose you have a set of points and you know some are similar to others. You immediately have a graph, and we want to define smoothness on the graph. So we first build this weight matrix, and on the weight matrix we put a 1 if two guys are similar, and we put a 0 if they're not similar. Okay. So now how do we define smoothness here? So what we need to do is define gradient. Well, we won't define gradient. Let's ignore the bottom half of this slide, but we will define the gradient squared. So the gradient squared is just the sum, the gradient squared at a vertex x is just the sum of the sum of the squared distances between all the points that are adjacent to x. So again, we had this weight matrix xy. In this case, W of x, y just has a 1 if x and y are similar, and it's a 0 otherwise. And then we define the gradient squared at a point x as just the square difference of the function between the values y, where y is similar to x. Okay? So actually, you can actually define the gradient of a function on a graph, but we don't care here. Okay, so let's actually do a concrete example. So we have, here's our graph. The numbers on the graph are function values on the graph. So you have a function, so phi of purple is 1, phi of yellow is 2, phi of red is 2, phi of blue is 4, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So this is the weight matrix that corresponds to this graph here. Okay, and if we want to calculate the gradient squared of phi at the blue point, well, we just look at each of the points that are adjacent to it, and we take the square of the difference of the function values. And that's the definition of gradient squared at the blue point. Okay, so now we know how to talk about, now we have this functional, which is the thing that we really wanted. That was kind of the tool. And we have this on the generalized setting. We have this on a graph now. Okay, so now we don't want weights to be just 0 and 1. There's a lot of situations where you want more general weights. So it's not any more difficult to define the gradient squared. You can do it just in the same way. You just put the wxy in front of the gradient term and in front of the difference term, and you're all set to go. So this is the definition of gradient phi squared at x at, with respect to some non-zero one weights. Actually, I didn't say it, but usually you expect the weights to be positive as well. So positive and symmetric in this case. It's not written there. Okay, so now we have weights. We know what smoothness is. What's smoothness? Smoothness is if you integrate, so I'm jumping between discrete and continuous, unfortunately. So before we had the integral of gradient squared. Well, we can do the same thing. We can measure the smoothness of a function on the graph just by taking the sum of gradient phi of x over the vertices x of the graph. And we have a nice functional that measures the complexity of a function or the smoothness of a function on that graph. Okay, but now we've got to figure out how to get weights. So there was this whole thing where we said, okay, we can define smoothness if we have weights, but now we need, there was a statement a couple slides back where he said, if we can get good features, then we can get smoothness out of structure. Well, we have to get good features. So roughly, how do we get features? How do we get weights? Well, we pick some features, we define a metric based on the features, and then we get weights from that. So what do we mean by features? Oh, actually, let me say one more thing, sorry. So what do we mean weights from a metric? Well, so you guys have seen this several times. A very standard thing to do is if someone gives you a metric, you want to define weights that have something to do with this metric. So what we do is we pick e to the minus metric xy squared over some t, and t is a parameter that defines a small scale. Now, you've seen this several times, and in some sense it doesn't matter. You can put almost any decreasing function of x and you can put almost any kind of radial or positive increasing function of x and y here, and it won't matter. And in fact, in a lot of places, just doing 0, 1, in other words, setting t to be 0, it won't matter. So you can just do 0, 1 weights in most situations, and you don't lose too much. But in general, if someone gives you a metric, we can construct the weights in this fashion. Yes?
I meant to mention this earlier, but this assumes that the bandwidth is constant across the whole feature space, right?
You mean the t?
The t, yeah.
So again, I don't want to get too much into the specific construction of the weight. So it's true that the scale of interest may be different in different places than the data set. And there are actually really nice ways of taking care of that. And this isn't the only thing that you can do. So I may have a slide much later where I'll show you where a very specific choice. We'll get to it. So there's probably, if we get to it, there's probably a slide which will give an exact, a really good solution to this. But this isn't the only thing. I mean, everybody picks this one just because it looks like a Gaussian that makes everyone happy. But, actually for a lot of image processing things, if you put a 4 here, it actually is an engineering thing. It just works better because of the shape of it. there's nothing canonical about this thing. There's no reason why we should put a global T. There's no reason why we should have a Gaussian at all in actual data analysis. But this the main reason why we want this e to the minus xy squared, rho xy squared, is we want things that are far away. In other words, where rho is decently big, we want to ignore that. What we really care about is things that are actually close together. If rho is small, we actually know something. If rho is big, we don't know anything. So we just want similarity where x and y are close. So there's nothing canonical about a Gaussian. Okay. So if we have a metric, we can get weights. How do we get a metric? Well, we just pick some functions on the torus, and we let the metric be defined by the difference between the difference between the function values. And this actually isn't a metric anymore. I mean, depending on what f is, so you can definitely choose f. So this isn't a metric, but that's okay. It is some measure of similarity between the points x and the points y, in terms of the features little f1 through little fd, where this is just a vector of functions. And we'll be slightly more specific in this in the next slide. But the point is, it's very general. You can pick any sorts of features that make you happy. It's of course application dependent. So let's become slightly more specific. And so this is a very convenient choice of features, which is useful in a lot of situations. Is you just pick linear features. In other words, you're given your image I. You pick some set of filters, and your feature vector is just the image convolved with the various filters. So the filters can be Gabor functions, they can be wavelets, they can be edge filters. So one thing we're going to look at a lot is if the filters are just image patch information. So this is, if you take filters that look like this, so G11 is a 1 in the top left, G12 is just a 1 in the 1-2 position, et cetera, then if you do this construction up here, so if you take these particular filters and you make this construction of features, then what you get is patches around each pixel. So each pixel has the feature vector sitting on top of it, which is all the values of the pixels around it. So let me draw the picture here. You have your image, you look at a pixel, and if you take filters that look like that, and you have your image, then the feature vector is just the value of the image at these particular pixels. Okay? And so if we take exponential weighting, then the operator we're going to get from this particular choice of features, in other words, the weights that we get from this particular choice of features, is exactly the NL means weight. So this is kind of a very popular method in image denoising now. Okay, so let's skip this slide. I'll talk about it later. We'll skip some technical points for a second, and we'll look at pictures. So what we want to do is, okay, so let me say what we're doing. Let's see, I was thinking, okay, so what I have is a picture of Lena, and what I'm going to do is I'm going to click on a pixel. And what's going to be displayed is we're going to look at the 100 pixels in a box, in a 10 by 10 box around the pixel that I click on. And those pixels are those. Each of those is a feature vector. It's a 5x5 feature vector. So it's a 25-dimensional vector. So I click on a pixel, and I get a 25-dimensional vector, which sits on top of that pixel. It's just the value of the points on a pixel. And what this is going to do is look at all the pixels in a 10x10 box around it. And we're going to look at what those guys look like together. Okay, so let's click on a pixel. Okay, so again, what I've done is it looks at a pixel, and the little white square is the 10x10 box. Now, for each pixel in that box, I look at the 5x5 box of pixels around it, right? So it's a 25-dimensional vector. Now, here you've displayed all the points, and it's actually in free space. Now, you can't actually look in 25 dimensions, so this has been dropped by PCA to 3 dimensions. And these are the PCA vectors here. So this is what the 10x10 patch looks like. And these are the points that were in 25-dimensional space, and they've been projected by PCA onto 3 dimensions, so we can look at them. Okay? So, and the patch was right here. And what you can see is that there's some very complicated structure. Now, in this case, you can't tell, you can't really tell too much about it because it's been crushed down a lot. These are the principal vectors here. This is the eigenvalues of the PCA right here. So it's really more than three-dimensional. So when, yes?
I didn't understand how you got from that 10x10 picture to a 25-dimensional picture.
Okay, sure, sorry. Let me go back to here. Okay, so what I do. We have the image here. We pick a spot. We make a 10x10 box, and we look at every pixel in this 10x10 box. Now, in this 10x10 box, we pick some. We're looking at these guys here. So this pixel here, we look at the 5x5 box around it, right? So this is has 25 numbers. Okay. So this is a stack of 25 numbers. So the coordinates of this pixel are the 25 numbers which are in the box around it, right? And I do this for each of the pixels in this big 10x10 box, okay? And, okay, so that's, is it okay?
Yeah.
Okay, so it's kind of hard to see structure here, but let's look at an edge. Let's see what happens when we look at an edge here. Now, the gray value up here is the actual gray value of the image. And what y'all should notice, the really important thing here is that here we had an edge. On the actual original image, we had a sharp edge. But if you look at the gray value as a function in this 25-dimensional space, rather than, well, it's actually been projected to 3, but it's completely smooth. Before, you had a function that was very sharp. There was a sharp edge that went from there to there. In this embedding, if you will, of those points, the function is completely smooth, right? And so this is, for us, a really great thing. It means that there's something to be gained, okay? And actually, you can see a lot of different fun structures when you walk around the image. So maybe over here, you get, let's see, that's not a good one. Let's find a nice one. Some of these you get some nice, anyway, so you can wander around the image and you find all sorts of interesting structures that they're not necessarily manifolds. So people keep talking about manifold learning because, for example, you saw in the edge when we clicked over here we had really a one-dimensional structure, right? And actually you could see it from the singular values. And here, if you look at the singular values, you have something which is really roughly three-dimensional, roughly, but it's definitely got some two-dimensional structure, right? So we don't have a manifold when we embed, but we have definitely some sort of geometric structure that we can take advantage of. And the point is, the gray value of the image is smooth with respect to that geometric structure, whatever it is. So that's the upshot. Okay. So let's. So, okay, so so what we did is we looked at the images, right? And now we saw that an image is smooth as a function of the features, if you took, for example, the patch features. So the image is smooth as a function of the features, so what does that mean? That means denoising, for example, is easier in that universe because you can apply the classical methods, because you can just try and minimize integral of gradient squared. So let's actually do it. We have the weights WXY say that we got from an exponential kernel with the distances in the patch space, we renormalize the kernel to be averaging. Why do we do this? Because if we want to, if we want to smooth out an image, well, we should pick some pixels and say, okay, who are we going to, how are we going to average it? Well, we need a row of this thing to be summing to one so that we actually get an average. Otherwise, you're going to make all sorts of craziness. So we renormalize this to have row sums one. Okay, and then once we have this k, well, we can just smooth out our image with k. So someone feeds you a noisy, image. Oh, those are supposed to be eyes. Okay, so these f's are supposed to be eyes. I apologize for that. So if someone gives you a noisy I, we just send I to k to the ni. So it's exactly like convolution with a Gaussian in the.
So again, you're denoising here.
Yes, I'm denoising.
So maybe, so I guess one of the main points here is that it's just, it has nothing to do with image processing. It's just that a function is Lipschitz on its graph. Constant bounded by.
Exactly.
Maybe you could draw the picture of this because somehow that's.
But it's slightly more.
I understand.
What?
I understand.
Because it's really this thing. The fact that you have a patch is really quite important.
Sure. But that's just a different place.
But okay. So let's see. So what Peter is saying is, suppose we have a. Let's see. Suppose we have a function which. And we'll make a. Actually, let's do the very simplest thing. Let's just do an edge. So we have a function which is zero here. And one here. So this is one, zero. And so we have this function. Right? And now we add some noise to it. So it really doesn't look like this. It's really jumping up and down all over this guy here. But so this function here is not smooth. There's a jump. Right? But if you look at the image of this, it has two values. Really, this is just a function, so you kind of turn your head sideways and look this way. Mm-hmm. This is a function defined on two points, right? Or two clusters. So all of the points here get mapped to this cluster here. And all of the points here get mapped to this cluster here. And the distance between the two clusters is large, right? But the function is completely continuous on each cluster.
So maybe it would be helpful if you rotated the dot like 90 degrees, right?
Okay.
Because you've done exactly what you said, but, well.
It's like down.
Okay. I give up now.
Okay, so, but the point is that all these points, if you look in the image, all these points are essentially at the same place, and all these points are essentially at the same place. And the reason why this is a smooth function with respect to this is because all the similarities are in between points within each cluster. There's no similarities across. So if you remember, we had this sum. If we wanted to look at, say we have a point in there, we want to look at this guy squared. Well, this is x, y. This is this guy here, but the only y, which are adjacent to x, live in the same place. Mm-hmm. So in fact, the gradient is zero, and the same over here. There's no adjacency here.
And then there's just a little bit of noise.
What?
Then there might be a little bit of noise that you had.
If we add a little bit of noise, you might get a couple of adjacencies. And actually, that's the point of doing, for example, a patch. For example, if you take a patch, you saw this little trail you get in between, but the point is that over many entries in the patch, the average of the noise is roughly zero, so it doesn't matter.
How do you manage the control into the main thing? Does it relate to what we just showed you?
Sorry?
So you can think of it as, you know, the graph of passing is related to the focal flap operator with density.
Sure.
So practically what you have with it is a potential well. Actually, two wells separated by a barrier if you have some interaction in between. And taking two pixels or three pixels just means that you have a potential that one dimension, but in two dimension or three dimension. And the eigenvalues are just the time to go through from one potential to the other through the variable. So everything can be very well understood.
So I'm slightly dubious that it explains all the, so it definitely explains, so what you're saying definitely explains stuff for edge, well, okay, so offline. Anyway, so if we have a noisy image, what do? We take our noisy image, we construct all these patches from the image. So we take a function on a grid, and then it gets sent to a bunch of points in 25-dimensional space. We make an affinity on that 25-dimensional space and get the kernel from it. And then we smooth the function with the kernel that came from those points. So it's linear. The process is linear. It's just evolution of a heat equation on the patches. It's completely nonlinear in the sense that the features depended on the image. So the features were these stacks of points that were in a patch, and that completely depended on the image. So we can evolve, so hitting the image with k is exactly like evolving the heat equation. It's exactly a step in the minimization of gradient I squared. So if we want to do, so I'm told this is called Jacobi iteration. If we want to do Jacobi iteration to minimize this guy here, we exactly hit our noisy image with k. And we go. And eventually you'll get to the constant function, but you stop long before then. Mm-hmm. Now, if you want to do something slightly different, and again, I apologize, these Fs are supposed to be I's, what you can do is have a heat source. So you take your initial noisy image and you think of it as a heat source, and you hit your noisy image with K, but you add back a little bit of the image again, a little bit of the noisy image. And you repeat, and you repeat, and you repeat. So what this is doing is evolving the heat equation on the patches, except there's a heat source, which is the original, image. So we might want to keep some fidelity.
Do the range changes?
No, we don't update the k. K does not get updated.
Do you have any intuition what happens when you do update k? Because Borel do update k.
So it's not as good actually, because usually you want very short times, and updating k. Okay, so this is a basic principle, as far as I can tell, in all data analysis, which is if you want to do data analysis, you don't denoise and then do data analysis, because you smear the information a lot of times that you want. And so what ends up happening is if you update, you smear it, and then you rebuild these patches, right? But then the geometry is really different. Like somehow somehow keeping all of the data is best for building the graph. So you can actually see one thing that happens, at least when I update, is that you get anisotropies very fast. You get weird corners because patches like, for example, patches like lines that go this way, and this way more than any other direction. So after five iterations with updating, you all of a sudden, every line in your image goes in one of those four directions. So here are some real examples, and so there's the image, there's the noisy image, there's the clean one, and here's the residual. And actually, this was done not with just patch filters, but the features were a combination of patches and Gabor filters. Okay, and then the same with Lena. So in terms of mean squared error or whatever, these are the best in the world, and as far as, I mean, they're quite good. I mean, I think they're the best in the world in terms of visual, just appreciation as well. But that's only true for, I mean, kind of natural images in Gaussian white noise. So, okay, so what if you don't have Gaussian white noise? So what is here is an image which has been JPEG to extremely small size, and then we did the same thing. So you build in this case the it's Gabor filters. So the features in this case are Gabor filters. And you build the graph from the Gabor filters, and you use the heat equation on the graph to smooth the image, and you get this thing here. And the cool thing is that you can think of this as being noise, which is extremely non-Gaussian, and you get actually a pretty decent result. And actually, I think you can do probably better. So I don't know if this is, I don't know how this compares relatively for this kind of problem. I know a lot of people have worked on this particular, very specifically on DJ-pegging images. So I don't know how well this does, but with no modification of the machinery, it does, I mean, at least visually, pretty decently. No, I'm not going to do the technical details because we have like 5 minutes. So I want to talk really quickly about segmentation. So this is this the function extension problem. So what we're going to talk about is supervised clustering, supervised segmentation. So this is the user will kind of input a few points and say, we want this point to be in one cluster, we want a different point to be in a different cluster. And the computer will have to fill in the rest of the points in the image. So the user will input very few points and the computer has to fill it up. So this is exactly the semi-supervised learning problem. If you've heard of this, you're given a few labels and you have to extend the labels to the rest of the rest of the data. And it's a function extension problem. It's not like the function extension problem like Jan LeCun was talking about, because you have all the affinities between the points that you're extending to. So it's a slightly easier extension problem. You're not going, you only have a few points that are, you have the function values for, but you have the geometry. You have the kind of true geometry between all the points, even the unlabeled ones. So what's a classical method for inpainting, or a classical method of extending a function that you expect to be smooth? Well, it's the harmonic extension method. So you have a function on R2, and you know the values at certain boundary points. You want to extend it to the rest of a domain instead of R2. You want to extend it to the rest of the domain. You find the harmonic function with the correct value, boundary values. So this, in some sense, is the smoothest function with those particular boundary values. So this has been used before in semi-supervised learning, and this was, I guess, first done. That exact formulation was done by Ju, Garamani, and Lafferty. So you do exactly the same thing. So what we saw before is we have a weight matrix W, and what we do, we can treat this as like a we can treat this as a heat operator or whatever. And in fact, I never said Laplacian yet, but exactly as in R2, when you have the identity minus a small heat. A small diffusion is kind of like Laplacian. You have the same thing on a graph, and we can talk about Laplacian equals zero on a graph. But another way of thinking about it is as follows. So all we want is the function that minimizes integral gradient squared with the correct boundary values, right? So here is the same graph that we had before, and for example, the user specifies one on red and minus one on green. Now, the harmonic extension to that function is the function minimizing gradient squared with those particular values at those particular points. Okay? And so this is actually that function. I mean, you can just compute it. How do you compute it? You just compute it by iterating W and iterating K applied to the function and re-updating those points at each time, for example. So we construct a harmonic function, harmonic in the sense that it minimizes the gradient, the integral of the gradient squared, and it has the correct boundary values. Let's not do that quite yet. So let's actually do an example. So it has to think a second. So it takes a second to construct the weight operator in this case. And again, the weights are the patches, except this time, well, I'll skip the details. Roughly, it's the same as the denoising thing from before. So what are we going to do? So in this case, the user is supposed to input classes, right? So here we take, we'll say, okay, this is one class, okay? And then we will pick some points outside and say this is another class. So this is why it's called a supervised clustering problem. Okay? And then let's kill this. And then so this is the clustering. This is the value of the harmonic function that we got. So we took these points, and they were actually embedded in 25-dimensional space, just like before, actually just in 7-dimensional space. It was crushed down to the principal components. But the same thing as before. And we made the function, which was, say, -1 here, -1 here, and 1 there. And we extended this function to be harmonic on the rest of the on the rest of the set. Now, it's not harmonic in the traditional Euclidean two-dimensional sense. It's harmonic in the way we said before. It's the function which minimizes gradient squared on the graph, or on the set of points. Mm-hmm. Okay, so you get something like this, which is really quite nice. And okay, so this is a segmentation. It's exactly extending something, and it stops whenever it sees something different. Now, the cool thing is that it's not just edges that it's stopping at. If you remember, a zebra has stripes, right? And you can't exactly, it's not just edges that'll stop it. So certain kinds of edges you want to stop at. These edges you want to stop at, and these edges you don't. And the reason why this works in this particular case is because it was, in some sense, massaged to work. I picked features that I know are going to work. What ended up being the features in this case is the principal components of the 25 dimensional stack, but that's exactly the DCT basis. In other words, what are the features here? Well, they're the low pass, then an oscillation in the x direction, an oscillation in the y direction, and then two oscillations in the x direction, two oscillations in the y direction, etc., and then up to some low number of oscillations. So the point is, these points are very similar, even though they lie on an edge, in this sense. But these points are really quite different. Okay, so let's. I guess I'm almost out of time, so I have like 4 minutes.
10 moments.
10? Oh, okay. So then let's look at some more pictures. Okay, so let's look at what these points look like, projected. Okay, so let's see. So what we're going to look at now is what the points actually look like. So the value, the color value is the same color value as the guy here. The XYZ is the XYZ is the first three principal components of the actual data. So again, we took our image of the thing, and each pixel was sent to a feature vector. And so the XYZ here is the principal components of the feature vector. Okay? And the value, the red-blue value, is the same as the harmonic function. And what's interesting is, you can almost separate, so I can tell you what the principal component is. The long direction is just the low pass. And this is actually something which is generically true of patches. If you take a lot of patches of an image and you take the principal components, the principal component will be the gray value will be the low pass. The next principal component will be the first DCT function in the x direction, and the third one will be the DCT in the y direction, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. This is, by the way, an empirical verification of JPEG. It says that if you have to find the principal components of patches of images, you exactly get DCT basis. Yes?
What's the low pass and what's the DCT?
Okay, sorry. Low pass is convolution with this function. So I look at the function. I have an image which is I from here, and I look at the function f, which is equal to 1 on a ball, say. And 0 otherwise.
That's pretty hard to see, even with image processing. So.
Okay, so let me give the short version. It's convolution with a Gaussian. The low pass is what you get after convolution with a Gaussian. Okay? DCT is discrete cosine transform. So when you do JPEG, so JPEG is the standard image compression that you use when you send stuff on the web. What does it do? It walks over your image, it looks at an 8x8 patch, and expands it in the discrete cosine transform, which is just cosines. It's just the cosines in the x direction and the cosines in the y direction. So it's the real version of the Fourier transform. Okay? So it expands it in a real Fourier series and then lops off the coefficients roughly. So that's JPEG, and so DCT is the actual function that are used. So DCT is just the real Fourier transform. And in JPEG, it's done over little 8x8 patches. And what this picture is telling you, what the distribution of the points in this picture is telling you, is that in some sense this is empirically optimal. It's because this direction here is one oscillation in one of the directions, and this direction here is one oscillation in the other direction, and this direction here is the low pass. So this is the average gray value, and this is the average change in x, and this is the average change in y. And what you can see is that you can almost segment the image just based on the average gray value. So it was kind of an easy problem. On the other hand, let's see, how much time is left? Okay, there are actually a lot of points. There are lots of little orange points here. You can't see too many. They're kind of covered because the balls are too big. There are lots of orange points here. And in fact, what are those? Those are exactly where the, those are exactly the white parts of the stripe. Let's see. Those are exactly the white parts of the thing. So a lot of these orange points, which are far over here, they had average gray value, which was very high, but they're quite different. They're quite different from the points with average gray value over here. So you did do something. So it wasn't a terribly difficult problem because, as you can see, the set was very well separated even in the PCA thing. But you did really do something because there's some pushing over here. So, but the beauty is you were able to take something which has a relatively complex structure if you look just at gray values. If you look just at gray values, this point is the same as this point here. But obviously they're quite different because the neighborhood is different. But what you find looking at this image here is that there really is a smoothness. So if this is your set of points, there really is a smoothness for the function which is, say, -1 here, 1 here, and -1 here. You actually can get a smooth function that's reasonable in that way. And I guess that's it.